Okay, good morning everyone, and welcome to week three of the series that we're doing, Unlocking, which is based on the book The Gift by Edith Eger. So let's just begin with a bit of a review. So last week we talked about the prison of avoidance and the dangers of avoiding issues, not confronting pain, trauma and suffering, learning to express. The importance of learning to express emotions that are even negative emotions, to be aware of them, to be conscious of them, and to express them. And we explained that even if they're negative, we're not in control, most of us. We all have negative feelings. It's just a matter of realizing and confronting that they are there, becoming comfortable with them, and then learning how to respond. The beautiful line that she says, the opposite of depression is expression. And the best model of that is, as we talked about, the laws in the Talmud, the laws of grief, the laws of mourning, which include both the concept of expressing grief, confronting it, giving room for the emotions to express themselves, and then learning how to respond by not grieving in excess, but letting go and moving on. We discussed the makeup of the human consciousness, which is intellect and feelings, and the importance of emotions and how emotions is really the core personality of the person. But nevertheless, there has to be moach shalit al alev, the brain has to rule the heart. And therefore, even when we express our emotions, which is important to do, we have to do it with the guidance and with having the control of our mind, not to become over needy, not to overwhelm or overwhelm the people that are listening, not to become a victim, not to insult other people, and so on and so forth. So even when we express our emotion, we need to do it with the proper guidance that's coming from the way we think. And as humans, we're able to do that, to make proper decisions and to think in the straight way. Before we continue on to today, I want to just remind everyone that, as I did last week, that Edith Eger actually speaking on Zoom twice in the next few weeks. Once this coming Monday night at 7:30 by the Kristallnacht anniversary program. It should be amazing. That's through the Board of Deputies, and I think the advertising's around. And the other one is on November the 18th, Wednesday, 8 p.m., which has been in our emails. You can see the advertising. It's run by AJFN, the group that deals with infertility and helps people with infertility. And she's being interviewed by Marga Lowy, and that should be also very, very interesting. Okay, so today I want to actually tackle two chapters, and they're sort of connected. That's one of the reasons I'm combining them together, and also because the book has 12 chapters and we only have a 5 weeks left to the series. So I want to start with chapter 3. Chapter 3 is a chapter to do with something that we've talked about many times, but I want to revisit it, and I want to sort of clarify an issue which came to my mind looking at the way it's described in the book, and hopefully develop a certain very, very important perspective on this particular topic. She starts off the topic, the chapter has a heading, all other relationships will end except with the one of ourselves, obviously, and the chapter is called The Prison of Self-Neglect. Now, as I said, it's something we've really spoken about many times. I just want to sort of bring an important aspect to the discussion today. But on a very basic level, it's obvious, and we know this, that we need to take care of ourselves physically, spiritually, emotionally, because we understand that it's so important that on any level, especially in the context of the chapters in this book, that to accomplish any one of the goals, right, that are discussed in this particular book, for example, to move away from victimhood, to express and confront failure or painful negative emotions, to overcome negative guilt or shame, as we'll talk about a bit later, right? Especially when some of these things are the default position of most human beings, right? We tend to be towards victimhood. We tend towards being negative sometimes. A lot of us do, right? We tend to bear guilt or shame for whatever reason that is. So in order to confront all of this, in order to overcome all of this, in order to achieve the things that she talks about in this book and other books that are described in these chapters, we obviously need a strong self, right? A strong self physically, emotionally, a strong acceptance, and a positive perception of ourselves, a positive belief in ourselves. And it's this strength and this self in self and this belief in self that has to be strong, it has to be intrinsic, it has to come from within in an unconditional way, it cannot be dependent on other people. We've talked about this so many times. And it cannot be dependent on anything or anyone else. It's got to come from within, a recognition, a consciousness of our intrinsic value, of our self-worth. And then as a strong human being, coming from a position of strength, we can then confront all of the different issues, all of the different prisons. We can achieve the freedom from all the different prisons that are described in this book so beautifully. Because if we don't have a strong self, in other words, and the result of not having a strong self means that we spend energy, we spend time, we spend effort consistently sort of propping ourselves up, proving ourselves to ourselves and to the world, right? What happens is we wear out, we burn out, and it becomes impossible to put in the hard work and the effort which is necessary, as I said, because a lot of us by default, we tend to some of these negative things. And it takes work. Growth takes work. Freedom, inner freedom takes work. And therefore, if we don't have the strong self, we don't have the strong sense of self, it's very hard to do any of the other stuff because we're busy, too busy protecting our fragile self. We're too busy proving ourselves, to other people, to the world around us. And we don't have really effort. We don't have koyach, as they say, left to engage in proper self-growth and achieving inner freedom. So that's why it's so important. So as Edith Eger begins the chapter, and I'm going to just read you a few excerpts before we discuss it. She says, one of our first fears is of abandonment. This is interesting, just a description of why this happens to people, why we have a fragile self. So she says, one of our first fears as an infant, in other words, is abandonment, right? Thus we learn early on how to get the three A's, attention, approval, and affection. We figure out what to do and whom to become to get our needs met. The problem is not that we do these things, it's that we keep doing them. All right, this is so important. We think that we think we must do these things in order to be loved. And as she goes on and explains, she says it's very dangerous to put our whole life into someone else's hands. You are the only one you're going to have for a lifetime. All other relationships will end. That's her line, interesting line. So how can you be the best loving, unconditional, no-nonsense caregiver to yourself? You know, it's also connected to one of Stephen Covey's seven habits, of course, sharpening the saw, making sure that before you're giving to others, you are well taken care of on all levels, psychologically, emotionally, physically, and so on and so forth. Anyway, she continues and says the following. In childhood, we receive all sorts of messages, spoken and unspoken, that shape our beliefs of how we matter and what we are worth. This is really important, especially important when we're in schools and as parents and so on. And we carry these messages into adulthood. Even if we didn't experience a discernible event or trauma that forced us to fight to be loved or seen, most of us can remember times we protected others or performed for them in order to secure their approval. We may have come to believe that we're loved for our achievements or for the role we fill in the family or because we take care of others. Unfortunately, she says, many families, in trying to motivate children to do well for themselves, create a culture of achievement. Now, encouraging children to achieve is really important, but what she's talking about is creating a culture of achievement in which the child's being, listen to this carefully, the child's being gets entwined with her or his doing. In other words, while we should encourage children to achieve, we encourage ourselves and each other to achieve, we shouldn't mix up the being and the doing. And this is such an important thing. We know we have two worlds, the world of being and the world of doing. The world of being is who we are, our real definition, our self-worth, our intrinsic value. And sometimes what we do is we mix up the world of doing and being. The world of doing is really important, but the world of doing doesn't define who the human being is. And often society's messages, the way we create them, and I think coming off the HSC, this is one of the great weak spots of where this happens, right, is that we create a culture where the doing defines the being. And that's such a confusion that's very, very bad. But if a good report card or good manners earn love, that's not love. That's manipulation. And then she makes a very, very interesting point, and I'm going to read it to you before we go into this. She says, too often we are boxed in by expectations, by the sense that we have a specific role or function to fulfill. Often in families, children are given a label. The responsible, this is the responsible child. This is the jokester. This is the rebel. When we give children a name, they play the game. And when there's a best in the family, a high achiever or good girl, good boy, there's usually a best worst. As one of my patients put it, my brother was very disruptive as a child. The way I got attention was being cooperative and being very good. But a label is not an identity. It's a mask or a prison. My patient said it beautifully. You can only be the good girl for so long. So again, let's just repeat that one phrase that she says. Too often we're boxed in by expectations, by the sense that we have a specific role or function to fulfill. Now, and she discourages parents from doing that. She discourages parents from sort of boxing children into a particular expectation, because we don't know how children will evolve. They might have other hidden talents, other interests, other ways of blossoming, other ways of shining, other ways of being successful. We should rather love them unconditionally for who they are in the terms of being, rather than box them into a set of expectations and then letting them define themselves by those expectations and living up to those expectations, good or bad, but not being able to break out from that rigid prison of that definition, which is dependent on the world of doing rather than the world of being. Now, I just want to make one point, however, that as parents, just as it's a parenting thing, but nevertheless, let me make this point very, very, very clearly. As parents, we should never box children in, and we should never define for them their path. However, that's true when it comes to the world of doing. It's not true, however, when it comes to the world of values. As parents, values have more to do with being than doing. In other words, in terms of doing, there are so many ways to do things, and there's so many different pathways. In terms of values, as one of our responsibilities as parents is to define values, is to instill values in our children. I think a lot of parents mix this up. In other words, yes, we are there to guide. Children are not able to define their own values. They're not mature enough to choose a moral and productive, meaningful life. It's us that we have to define that. We have to choose those values that we subscribe to and hopefully impart them to our children as an absolute conviction and as a belief system. But however, those values can be implemented and expressed in many different ways. So we need to make that distinction between values and achievements. Achievements belong to the world of doing. Values have more to do with who we are, and that's the world of being, and that's certainly a role that parents do play, or we all play as leaders or as friends or whatever the case is, to inspire people with those values that we hold so dear. Okay. But nevertheless, the point she's making, that we are sent messages as children very often, that our love is earned by achieving, our definition is created by the world of doing, that's a very, very sad but very real problem. And what that leads to is an insecure self, a person who's always fighting to live up to that expectation. What that leads to is a very low self-perception often, a low self-esteem, and therefore we fight to protect the fragility of who we are, and that stands in the way of investing the effort to achieve the other things that are spoken about in the book, breaking out of the prisons of victimhood, breaking out of the prisons of guilt and shame, and so on and so forth. Now, I think it's important to reflect on this for a few moments, on this process, exactly how this works, because it's an issue we've talked about many times, but I want to sort of reflect on how it actually works, and how this idea of self-love, self-acceptance, preservation of self, caring for self, which is all important, but how it actually is implemented and how it plays out, particularly in the context of Jewish thought. And I say this because the rest of the chapter where Edith Eger talks about this is a little bit vague. And I think, already from the last book, the choice, and from this book, I think she's absolutely amazing. She's an incredible inspiration. That doesn't mean that everything she says is 100% true, nor do we have to agree with everything she says. And I think there's parts of this chapter where I take a little bit issue with, or perhaps to be fair, it's maybe just a little bit vague, and I think can be very misunderstood. And I want to point it out because it's a very, it's a concept which can be easily misunderstood and implemented wrongly. And I think she alludes to this in the Book of Her Choice, where she herself says that she implemented some of Viktor Frankl's theories wrongly to begin with, and only later broke out of it and realized how it's supposed to be expressed. So I think it needs clarity and it needs a bit of a sort of a perspective. So I'm going to just read to you an interesting little story, a couple of stories she says, and I want to read to you some of how she describes how this plays out, and then analyze it a bit and give this perspective. So she says, Lucia is a nurse. She talks about a client of hers, I guess, right? And told me she thinks that it's in her genetic code to focus on others. Now, many, many people are very, very selfless, but it's true. A lot of people focus on others because they escape themselves. In other words, they focus on others to gain approval. They think they're weak. They'll be badly perceived if they don't focus on others. So they dedicate their entire life to focus for others. So she says, I'm wired to ask to other people, what do you need? How can I help? And she says, it took decades of marriage to a demanding man, stepping in to raise his children, including a daughter with disabilities, years of being told, do this, do that, before she started to ask, what about me? Who am I in this situation? Which is completely legitimate. Now, she says, now she's learning to be more assertive, to stop disconnecting from her own preferences and desires. Sometimes it garners a rocky response from others. So she describes the first time this Lucy set boundaries with her husband, refusing to get up from the couch to fix him a snack. He yelled, I ordered you to do this. Now, that's just abuse, obviously, right? She took a deep, stabilizing breath and said, I don't take orders. If you speak to me that way again, I'll leave the room, which is a great strength, and it's a perfectly legitimate way of setting a boundary. No one should ever ask someone else to do something and say, I've ordered you to do it, particularly in a relationship. It's not the role anyways. No one's anyone's servant. She's learning to recognize that the clinching feeling at the top of her gut when she starts to say yes to a request is a signal to stop and ask herself, is this what I want to do? Will I be resentful if I do this? So what she's advocating is that sometimes we just need to say no rather than do something for someone else and feel resentful a bit after. Now, it is not good to do something for someone else and feel resentful. And in the case of Lucy that you just described, it's obvious that the legitimate response in order to set a boundary was to say no. Well, say no, I don't get ordered around like that. You don't talk to me like that. And fix your own snack, right? And that's perfectly legitimate. However, what needs to be clarified, and it's going to come sort of clearer in the next story, is the response always not to do the thing? In other words, if I do an act of kindness or I do an act of selflessness and the result is I feel resentful, I do need to create boundaries. I do need to focus on myself. I do need to build inner strength. But the question is that the way to do it? To say no. Not always, I think, and let's explore this. Because she starts with a very interesting line. She says, it's good to be selfish. Now, she doesn't mean selfish. She puts a hyphen. You can't see this, but you put a hyphen in the middle. It's good to be selfish, to practice self-love and self-care. So she tells the following story. And this is a story I'm in two minds. I'm not 100% sure if it was the right response. But whether it was or it wasn't, then I'll leave it to you to decide. But it does give room for the discussion that I want to have with you today. She says, when Lindsay and Jordan were young, that's her grandchildren, Marianne and Rob, that's her daughter and son-in-law, made a commitment to give each other solo nights away from the family scene. Nice arrangement. So on Marion's night out, Rob agreed to be home with the kids and vice versa. So each week, one of them had a night where they would take care of the kids and the other would go out and have some fun. One week, a famous economist was going to be visiting from London and Rob wanted to hear him speak. But the event was on Marianne's night out. She'd already purchased tickets to see a play with a friend and he'd already made a commitment to be home with the kids. When he told Marianne he couldn't find a babysitter on such short notice, she could have called her friend to reschedule and contacted the theater to try and exchange their tickets for another night. We can always make the choice to be accommodating or to be flexible. The problem is that many of us rush to fix and adjust just out of habit. We take too much responsibility for others' problems, training them to rely on us instead of on themselves, and paving our own way towards resentment down the road. So what happened in the story? Marianne gave Rob a kiss on the cheek and said, "Gosh, honey, it sounds like you have a dilemma. I hope you can figure it out." In the end, he brought the children with him to the lecture, and they played under the auditorium chairs in their pajamas. I'll leave it to you to think if that was the right response or not, but it gave my mind reason to think about this, which I'm going to share with you in a minute. I'll just read one more paragraph. She says, "Sometimes life requires us to go with the flow. Sometimes it's the right thing to prioritize others' needs to modify our plans." So I'm glad that she is clarified with that. "And of course, we want to do everything in our power to support our loved ones, to be sensitive to their needs and desires, to engage in teamwork and interdependence. But generosity isn't generous if we chronically give at the expense of ourselves. If our giving makes us a martyr or fuels our resentment, love means that we practice self-love, that we strive to be generous and compassionate towards others and to ourselves." So this concept of focusing on self and setting boundaries is all true. It's 100% true. In that story, maybe her wife, maybe the Marianne thought that Rob is doing this too often. He's becoming too dependent. So it was a boundary she thought that she needed to set. I'm not sure. Because sometimes it is good to be selfless, and sometimes it's good to work it out and be flexible. However, I had to kind of stop when I read this and just think about this whole concept. Because I want to explore this whole idea sort of on a deeper level from a Jewish perspective and just try and clarify a couple of things. See, it reminds me a little bit of the danger that this discussion can also result in, right? And I have found this. I found that sometimes, you know, although, as you know, I'm very, very passionate about personal growth. We've been now getting together every Thursday morning for over 10 years and talking about personal growth. Apart from all the other binner discussions and lectures and mindfulness and relationship stuff and so on and so forth. So I think it's clear. Personal growth is very, very, very critical to our development. Yet there are people that often, I'm talking about a general thing now, and I'm gonna get to self-worth in a second. There are people that get so into personal growth that in fact, instead of leading it to growth, it actually leads to self-absorption and being incredibly needy. Because here's the danger. Personal growth focuses a lot on me. When I think about it, I think about how I'm doing. I think about my qualities. I think about my personality. I think about how I'm growing. I think about am I being selfish or selfless. I think about my character, right? I think about living more mindfully. It's a lot of thinking about I. And therefore, everything has a danger to it. Being very, very involved in reading self-growth books and discussing self-growth and personal growth and personal development sometimes can actually lead to the exact opposite. Sometimes can lead to being so absorbed in oneself that we're thinking about I the whole time that we actually become trapped rather than a person that grows. And we need to be aware of that. And we end up becoming needy, and we end up talking a lot about ourselves and thinking a lot about ourselves rather than actually growing as a human being and thinking about our values and our meaning and our purpose, which includes our relationships and the care and the focus on others beyond ourselves. Personal growth, the definition of personal growth, is to grow beyond ourselves, not to grow into ourselves. Now, this is true, and if this becomes the problem, this will manifest itself really badly, right? In the whole process of building our own self-worth, self-acceptance, as she describes it, to do away with our own insecurity. This will manifest itself very badly when we're trying to combat our definition being dependent on others' approval or others' perception of ourselves. Why? Because, you see, what happens is like this. Sometimes, when we're insecure and we build up resentment by always trying to please other people and we realize that we're doing it and we fight it, as she describes it, we should do in the book, and we fight it by setting boundaries and so on and so forth. But sometimes what happens is the exact opposite. Sometimes we replace the insecurity with a superiority complex. In other words, sometimes we replace the fragility of self with the overprotection of self. I hope I'm being clear with that. So therefore now I'm not going to be dependent on other people, so I'm going to reject other people. I'm not going to do favors for people just because I need their approval and I don't want to be resentful and I don't want people to overuse me and I'm not going to be used and abused. So what am I going to do? I'm going to shut out everyone else. I'm going to say no to everyone. Now, that doesn't normally happen, but that's a danger. In other words, what we're doing is we're actually not dealing with our real self-esteem issue. We're not dealing with recognizing our true self-worth. We're actually still stuck in protecting ourselves. We're still stuck in our insecurity. We're still stuck in the overprotection or the self-absorption. The only difference is that instead of being insecure, we now become self-absorbed. Instead of being insecure, we're now protecting our insecurity a different way. So one way to deal with our insecurity is to be everyone else's schmatter. The other way of dealing with our insecurity is to be better than everyone else and to shut out everyone else and to be able to say no and be selfish rather than selfless. So that's a really, really a big problem, and it's a very subtle and nuanced thing that we really, really have to think about. Because I want to just go into a bit of a mystical concept, a concept that's discussed in Jewish philosophy and Jewish mysticism. Before I do that, let me just define something. So when we're talking about like balancing self-care and kindness to others, it's actually not so much about a balance. It's not about balance. I think that's a mistake. It's not about balancing. I mean, obviously it has to do with balancing on a practical level, but it's not so much about balancing. What it is, it's more about examining where things come from. In other words, it's not about how much dose of kindness I have versus how much dose of self-care I have. It's much more about examining ourselves to see where does my kindness come from? Because what I will submit to you and of course we have to take care of ourselves, that's not a question. But I will submit to you the following, that actually if our kindness, if our generosity to others, if our selflessness comes from a strength rather than a weakness, it doesn't matter that we have an imbalance between doing for others and doing for ourselves. It's fine to be selfless and to do more for others than we do for ourselves, providing we're taking care of ourselves. But it's fine to do more for others if the doing for others comes from the right place. So it's not so much about the balance. It's about where it's coming from inside of us. So we find in Hasidic philosophy, in mysticism, and I'm just going to spend a few minutes on this because it's such an important idea. We find in Kabbalah, we find this concept called Bitul Hayesh. Bitul Hayesh means, it's a hard word to translate, but it means not just humility, but it means the concept of self-negation, self-abnegation, moving away, being allergic to focusing on self, which is, in other words, eradicating any trace of ego, right? But it's more than that. So the concept of a yesh, the concept of being into ourselves by being present and being sort of taking ourselves too seriously, in Hebrew is the word being a yesh, in other words, being I exist. It's expressing that concept that, you know, I am here. And in Jewish philosophy, in mystical philosophy particularly, there's this tremendous emphasis, no, you have to negate that. Now we'll see where that works. Not to focus on self. There was that tremendous thing about not focusing on self. There was almost a disdain of this concept of focusing on self. I'll tell you just a little story to bring it out clear. Bear with me; it'll become clear what I mean with this in a few moments. There was a famous story about a disciple of the Maggid of Mizrich, who had come to the Maggid of Mizrich to learn for a few years and study there. And then One day he came to an end and he went to the Magid of Mizrich and he says, I've come to take leave. And could you, you know, come to take leave, could you give me your blessing and I'm going back to my birthplace and my family. And I'll come back once in a while, but I'm taking leave. So the Magid of Mizrich says, yes, sure, I give you my blessing, but I'd like to ask you a favor. On the way home, you're passing through a particular town and there is one of my disciples. His name is Reb Aaron of Karlin. Reb Aaron of Karlin became afterwards a very great Hasidic Rebbe in his own right, a very, very tremendous person. And could you go by and pass by his house and give him regards for me? Sure. No problem. He goes to the town and he passes by the town where Reb Aaron of Karlin was, and it was already late at night. But eventually he found Reb Aaron of Karlin's address. It was a very cold winter night. And he realized that Reb Aaron of Karlin is still up because there was a candle burning in the window. It was obvious that Reb Aaron of Karlin was sitting and studying and therefore he was still up. So he felt comfortable, particularly it was very cold anyway. He felt comfortable to knock on the door. He knocks on the door. Reb Aaron Karlin was deep in study and deep in sort of spiritual connection with God. But he heard the knock at the door. He gets up and he quietly says, Veridos in Yiddish says, who's there? So this student, who was a friend of Reb Aaron Karlin from the time that he was in the Magid of Mizrich's court, he says, in Yiddish, he says, Ich, I. So Reb Aaron Karlin just doesn't open the door. Goes back to learning, and this guy's stuck outside, and he's a bit cold and a bit hungry, and he couldn't understand. Reb Aaron Karlin is a great tzaddik, and is a person who's known for his love of others, and so on and so forth, and why is he not opening the door? So he thought maybe he didn't hear it properly, so he knocks again. A few seconds later, he hears the voice of Aaron HaKalin once again, and he says, Veridos, who is there? And he says, Ich. No answer. It doesn't come to the door. Anyway, he's getting a bit desperate. The third time, he says, he knocks on the door loudly, and again, Aaron HaKalin says, Veridos, who is there? So he says his name. Aaron HaKalin comes to the door, and he opens the door. And he welcomes him in. He says, oh, so nice to see you. He says, where are you going? He says, I've left the Magid of Mizrich. I'm going home. I'm now going to settle down and so on and so forth. So Reb Aaron of Karlin looks at him and he says, my friend, I'm not sure you're ready to leave the Magid of Mizrich. I'm not sure you fully absorbed the message that we were supposed to learn by the Magid of Mizrich. When I answered the door, when you knocked at the door and I asked who it is, you said, Ich. Now, it was a well-known concept by great Hasidim, great mystics, that the word Ich was wrong. This Ich was like, I am here. And I could tell from the way you said Ich, you're still focusing on self. You've grown, you've become spiritual, but the Ich is still there. As I said, there was a disdain for this concept of Ich. You know, tonight, I'll just mention this, tonight and tomorrow is the 19th of Cheshvan. That's the yahrzeit of my father-in-law, Dina's father, 4 years ago. He was my teacher when I was in yeshiva before we got married. This was an unbelievable Torah genius. He was a person that was well-versed in the entire Talmud and a great leader and a great teacher. And he was someone that was a great example of this. He was allergic to talking about himself. He never spoke about himself. I don't ever remember him talking about himself. What he'd done, what he's accomplished, never. And he hated it. And he used to get upset when he used to read about in the magazines about people talking about themselves, describing their accomplishments. And not because he was weak. He was actually very strong within himself. He was a strong teacher and a great inspirer. But he had this thing about, and he had plenty to be arrogant about. But there was just not, because he explained many times that his chinuch, his education in the yeshivas that he learned in and by the teachers he learned from, was that we're not here for ourselves. We're not here. We're here to be connected to something higher than ourselves. The focus on self, even when it's a good thing, is a little bit dangerous. And he played it out. He was always he never liked to get in people's way. He never liked to inconvenience people. He always if he needed a favor from someone, he would ask. And that's okay. That's a strength we all need to have. We need to reach out. We help each other. But it was always never, he never made it, He was a person who had a tremendous presence and yet wasn't there. He made unbelievable room for other people. Because when we focus on ourselves, it doesn't matter how we do it, we make less room for others. So I'm just describing this. I'm getting back to this concept that we do find this concept of bitul hayesh, self-abnegation, self-negation, in a healthy way. I saw an article where someone discusses, because we find this concept in other disciplines as well. Buddhism has a lot of, for example, has a lot on self-abnegation, right? But it's very, very different. Because in Judaism, when we talk about self-negation, it's not diluting oneself. It's not negating oneself. It's not taking away oneself. It's about connecting to a greater self, to a greater something. And this is the point. We've made this a number of times, different ways. This is the point. Self-negation doesn't mean to dissolve ourselves. What it means is, it means that we're part of something much greater. It means that whatever we do, we realize that the essence of who we are is a godly soul. That we don't exist in an independent way. We are connected through our soul to a much greater presence, to a much greater existence. That doesn't make us small, that actually makes us bigger. But it also makes plenty of room for other people. And it makes us more secure. In other words, it's understanding who we really are. It's understanding what our real definition is, and understanding who the real essence of who we are is, that godly spark. It's understanding that we stand before God. If we stand before God, we have nothing to be arrogant about. We have nothing to be egocentric about. We have nothing to boast about. We have nothing to be superior to other people about. But it doesn't make us weaker. On the contrary, it makes us stronger. It makes us that we have this intrinsic value, not because we just are a human being, we have intrinsic value because we are in the image of God, because we have an unbelievable infinite spark and infinite potential at the very core essence of who we are. So when we talk about self-negation, we're not talking about self-negation and disappearing. We're talking about self-negation and accomplishing even more and being stronger even more. We find this by, you know, we find this in the concept of leadership, for example. In other words, it's I exist, but I exist because I'm part of something higher. I don't exist as an egocentric, independent being. I exist because I am something much, 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 much greater than myself. Which means I can be strong when I need to be strong. I can be a strong leader if I need to be a strong leader. I can be powerful. I can achieve the main things, but it's not me. It's my ability to connect to something much greater than me, giving me more power, more potential. Just to give you an example of a story in Tanakh, we find by King Saul. King Saul was considered very, very humble, the first king of the Jewish king, but he was too humble. And it played out eventually that when he needed to stand up to others, he was unable to do that because the humility was a bit misplaced. King David, on the other hand, was also considered very holy. He was also considered very humble. And he became the king because God said, I need a strong leader. I need someone who, the humility is not a sign of weakness. The humility is a sign of strength. The non-focus on self is a sign of a greater self. It's being part of a greater person. When we self-negate, it's not killing ourselves, not eliminating ourselves, it's becoming part of something greater. It's becoming much more powerful, but not with a focus on self. So, therefore, why I say that is as follows. When we have a true sense of worth, a true sense of self-worth, what that means is we understand who we are, we understand our intrinsic value, we understand the core essence of who we are, that is the soul. And therefore, all the values that we express, all the values that we live by, are coming from that strength. In other words, we don't depend on others, and the way we live doesn't depend on other people's perspective or approval, nor does it depend on self-preservation. Because once we realize who we really are, once we realize that the weak self doesn't really exist, but the strong self does, in other words, the greater connection to something higher than ourselves, then we are intrinsically infinite, we are intrinsically strong, we are intrinsically unmovable, and our self-worth and our core purity that we all have can never be undermined. And then generosity, selflessness, all of these things are great values because they're coming from a strength and not from a weakness. What that also means is that when we perceive self-worth in that context, then we don't need to be worried so much about the balance. We just need to worry about, do we have that perspective? See, I'll tell you an interesting thing. For example, the Torah tells us, the Talmud says, that one of the greatest personality traits, one of the greatest spiritual levels that a person could achieve, which is very hard, by the way, is shom'im cherpatam ve'einam mishivim. When a person is able to hear offensive words, shameful words from others, and not respond. Now let's break that down a little bit. Does that mean we just take abuse from everyone? No. First of all, a person shouldn't be allowed to abuse us or undermine us. And if we don't answer, or if we don't have the conversation with others, or we don't express those emotions to others in an effective way, and we just give room to complete resentment, then obviously it's a sign that the reason we didn't answer wasn't because of a value, it was because we're weak. And that's a problem. And that's where we need to worry about setting boundaries and about protecting ourselves a little bit. But so then what does the Talmud mean that it's such a great virtue to let someone, you know, you can be in a crowd and someone can really offend you and you don't answer? Why is that such a virtue? It's a virtue if it's coming from a strength. And that's what we have to work towards. It's a virtue because if someone says something to me, I'm so strong within myself. I have such a sense of self-protection, meaning not self-protection, but self-worth. Because I know my soul, I know who I really am, I know my connection to God, I know the spark and the purity which is unmovable, which lies at the heart of who I am, that I don't let the abusive words of someone else affect me. Now again, obviously there's exceptions. If the person is close to me and it's inhibiting my way of expressing myself and it's blocking me from being able to achieve, that's all different. I'm just saying generally, right? In other words, it's not always that we have to stand up for ourselves. Sometimes the way we stand up for ourselves is by not answering. Because if it's coming from a strength. So it's not just about the balance. So for example, if I have to move my plans for someone else, like in that story, I think it depends what it's coming from. If it's coming from a weakness because I can never say no, and therefore it can happen again tomorrow, it can happen again next week, and I'll be taken advantage of and misused, that's a problem. And I have to learn the balance. But selflessness is a real value. Selflessness is a beautiful value. Now, of course, we need to take care of ourselves. And if it becomes too much, we need to set boundaries. But selflessness in Judaism is a real value. And therefore, when someone asks me a favor that means inconveniencing myself, if I'm able to do it not because I'm insecure, if I'm able to do it not because I'm weak, and therefore I always have to give in, but I'm doing it from a strength, from a sense of real selflessness, that's a value. That's a real value. So it's not that simple. The setting of the boundaries needs to be very careful. And that's why I mention all this, because I think, you know, there's a great virtue also that's talked about in Jewish sources called vitur, levater. We try to teach kids to do this, to let someone else, to give space to someone else, to give up on something so someone else can have it. Now again, if that comes from a weakness and then we get taken advantage of and it inhibits and it creates, you know, hate and resentment, that's a big problem. But it's still a value. The goal is not just to strike a balance. The goal is to have that value coming from a strength. I hope I'm being clear today, but it's to have it coming from a strength. Let me just give you an example. I've mentioned this example before, but I think it brings it out. Avraham Avinu, Abraham our forefather. It's a story we read about in this week's Parsha. The most selfless human being. Now, I'll give you an example of how selfless he was, which for some people would be ridiculous. It would be coming from a weakness and it would be actually not the way to go about it, right? Everyone has to know their own situation. So Avraham Avinu circumcises himself at 99 years old. God comes to visit him. He's recuperating from major surgery. God makes it hot outside so that there shouldn't be guests that bother Avraham Avinu. And Avraham Avinu is upset. He wants guests. He's sitting at the door of the tent in the heat of the day looking for guests. Guests suddenly arrive because God saw he's in pain. So he sent him three angels dressed up as human beings. He runs after them. He's weak. He's 99. Okay, people lived longer in those days. But he's 99. He runs. And he doesn't get anyone else to do it. He runs, he begs them, please come in for a bite. He himself goes and tries to get the menu together. He goes into Sarah's tent and asks her to make a meal, but he himself goes to the cattle and gets calves and wants to prepare for them a meal. He's running back and forth. He's obviously in pain. We know he's in pain because it was the third day after his circumcision, and we are taught that that's the worst day, and God had come to visit him, to visit the sick, and so on and so forth. Total selflessness. Is that just bad? Is he being silly? Well, he's not being silly, because by Avraham Avinu, it was coming from a strength, not from a weakness. How do we know that? It wasn't just coming because he needed to be popular. If a person's generous just because they need to be popular, that's a problem. I'm not sure they have to stop all the generosity all the time. I mean, certainly if they care themselves, but he was okay. But how do we know it was not because he wanted to be popular? How do we know that the generosity was coming from a strength, not from a weakness? It was coming from a value of selflessness and not to prove himself or to be dependent on other people? The proof is the next part of the story, that he tells these people to please wash their feet before they come into his tent. Why? The commentaries tell us, we've mentioned this before, that in those days it was part of pagan worship to serve the dust on your feet. These people looked like the natives of the land who engage in that practice, that they were serving the dust on their feet, a form of idol worship. Idol worship, idolatry, went against every part of Abraham's values. He was the proponent of monotheism. He was the teacher of belief in God. Belief, faith, emunah, the fight against idolatry was part of who he was. That was his value system. And he tells them, please come in, but you have to wash your feet before you come in, because idol worship doesn't come into my house. And that's okay. Values are strengths. We have to have conviction. So he wasn't after a popularity test, because he told them they can't come in unless they wash their feet. And yet, he was completely selfless at 99, recuperating from a surgery, trying to be hospitable to people who didn't even agree with. That's selflessness that comes from a strength. So I mention this because in reading this chapter, one has to be a little bit careful. Yes, we have to set boundaries. Yes, we have to take care of ourselves. But it's deeper than just creating a balance. It's about learning who we really are, building up the inner strength, understanding our inner value, accepting ourselves unconditionally because of who we really are at the very essence, taking responsibility for what we do, and living by our own inner values, coming from within, living from within out rather than out from within, as we've talked about so many times. And then it's not so much about the values. Of course, we need to take care of ourselves, but taking care of others and taking care of ourselves becomes the same thing. And we have to live by values, including giving up for others, including making space for others, including selflessness and so on and so forth, coming from a strength, not from a weakness. So we need to be careful that in the quest for loving ourselves, as she puts it in the book, which I'm sure she means the right thing, that we don't fall into the trap of substituting insecurity with over self-protection and self-preservation, but rather to become selfless by understanding who we really are. Which fits into the next chapter, which I'm just going to mention briefly because we're coming towards the end, but I don't want to not do it this week because I want to cover some other chapters as well. She has a chapter on guilt and shame. Now, I must just tell you that guilt and shame the terminology is very confusing, because, you know, we've talked about guilt and shame in Dr. Pelkovitz's book. We've talked about it in Rabbi Sachs's writing. We've talked about it in other things, other contexts. And every time it means something else. We just have to be very clear. There's good guilt and bad guilt, and good shame and bad shame. But as we talked about with Dr. Pelkovitz's discussion. So let's just, for the purpose of this, say that guilt is shame is the negative part of guilt, and guilt is the good part of guilt. Although in this chapter she calls guilt and shame negative, and the good part she calls remorse. But she talks about the concept of guilt, and guilt is generally a negative thing. Shame is a negative thing because, again, it's dependent on other people. And it's a prison. She talks about the time that she graduated from college in 1969. She was 42 years old, don't forget. But she still hadn't gone through the process of healing. She'd been growing. She went to school. She was an immigrant. She had courage, resources to learn English, and so on and so forth. And she didn't go to her own graduation ceremony. Why? She says, I was too ashamed. Because like many survivors in the years after war, I grappled with crippling guilt. You know, why was I liberated? Why not my parents? Why not my sister? All that kind of things. Because guilt is a weakness. Guilt is when you, or bad guilt, I should say, is when you blame yourself, right? Which, of course, is the opposite of what we call remorse, or what Rabbi Sacks calls the difference between shame and guilt. So here it's the same concept we've talked about before. Remorse, or good guilt, as Rabbi Sacks calls it, is a really, really important thing. Why? Because good guilt does not deal with who I am. It deals with what I did. And what I did, I need to take responsibility for. And feeling remorseful, or feeling a sense of discomfort by things that I've done, is a healthy thing, not a bad thing. Because I'm separating, as Rabbi Sacks says in one of his articles, quoting from the Talmud, I separate between the sin and the sinner. The sin is bad. What I did was bad. I made a mistake yesterday, but that's okay. I need to feel remorse. But guilt means to blame myself, to say that I'm bad, to then do whatever I can to gain approval from other people. Right? As Rabbi, I'm going to just share with you something Rabbi Sacks says, which is so good. He says, the biggest difference is that in shame cultures, if we're caught doing wrong, there's a stain on our character that only time can erase. But guilt cultures can make a sharp distinction between the doer and the deed, between the sinner and the sin. That's why guilt cultures focus on atonement and repentance, apology and forgiveness. The act was wrong, but on our character there's no indelible sin. And that's the same thing, because when we understand who we really are, we're able to take responsibility for what we do. We're able to be, it's coming from a strength. So good guilt and bad guilt, the difference is, where does it come from? If it comes from a good sense of self, who I am, as we've talked about so many times, at my essence, at my core, I'm pure, I'm complete, I'm connected, there's nothing wrong with me, there's something wrong with what I did, I can then take responsibility for it, I can feel remorse, I can have a little bit of a sense of a healthy guilt, and I can act upon it. If I ever, my guilt is coming because I'm ashamed of others, I'm embarrassed because I got caught. Why am I embarrassed? Because my whole essence depends on the approval of others. That's unhealthy guilt. And therefore that just sends us deeper and deeper into insecurity, into being dependent on others. And it leads to a paralysis of being able to function properly and to able to progress and grow. So that concept, releasing ourselves from the prison of unhealthy guilt, is very much connected with this concept of the prison of self-neglect. We should not neglect ourselves. We should take care of ourselves, meaning we should first of all create, sharpen the saw on a very basic level. We should protect our health. We should make sure we don't burn out. We should make sure that we protect the body that God gave us as much as we are generous and take care of others. We should take care of ourselves. But on a deeper level, not neglecting oneself means to develop a healthy sense of self, which means not to create a balance. It means to actually understand who we really are, to exercise actually real humility, to even exercise what the mystics call self-negation. But self-negation doesn't mean reducing ourselves or disappearing. It means understanding who we really are and being part of a much, much greater self. So that's the concepts I wanted to share today. That's the perspective. And hopefully in the coming weeks, we'll look at some of the other fascinating chapters. In the meantime, wish everyone just a good day and a wonderful Shabbat and a wonderful week.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You're welcome. You're welcome. All the best.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you.
You are an inspired teacher.
Thank you.
Rabbi, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rabbi.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Have a good day, everyone.
Wonderful. So wonderful.